Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Alturas Institute's presentation of America Reimagined. This is a program that invites experts from around the nation to take stock in America and to contemplate or imagine what our nation might look like under different circumstances, under different programs, and under different policies. I am Dr. Caroline Heldman. I'm the chair of the CTSJ department at Occidental College, and I'm also the chair of the Alturas Institute's board of directors. And it is my absolute honor today to introduce our guest. He is the president and founder of the Alturas Institute, Dr. David Adler. David is a constitutional scholar and also a renowned presidential historian. He is the author of 6 books and more than 100 scholarly articles in the leading journals in his field. Dr. Adler has been quoted by the U.S. Supreme Court, lower federal courts, the Secretary of State, attorneys general, the White House Legal Counsel, as well as both Republicans and Democrats in Congress. He is well cited by legal scholars, political scientists, and historians. Dr. Adler is currently writing a book about the landmark case of Reed versus Reed, which originated in Idaho and transformed the law for women. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was part of the Reed versus Reed case, and Dr. Adler's work to bring light to this important history will be profound. So let's get started. Dr. Adler, tell us about the Alturas Institute. What does it aim to do? What is its purpose?
Thanks very much, Dr. Heldman. So the Alturas Institute was created about 6 years ago, and the purpose was to create an educational organization that could help to advance American democracy by promoting the Constitution, civic education, equal protection of the law, and of course, gender equality, all very, very important missions. And so the Alturas Institute began by hosting a marvelous conference, which has become an annual conference called Conversations with Exceptional Women, held in Sun Valley, Idaho. And we've been so fortunate to host some of the most prominent women in America, including Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, Nobel Prize winners, Pulitzer Prize winners, Olympic athletes, CEOs, leading governmental officials, stars from the CIA, and others. And we've been very, very happy to gather for 2 days some of these incredible women to hold forth, to discuss some of the most prominent issues confronting America, particularly those that have constituted challenges and hurdles that women face on a daily basis in the workplace and beyond, and to raise the ever-present question, how far do we have to go before this country enjoys genuine gender equality? And that program, which we lost this year because of COVID, of course, would have featured the late Justice Ginsburg as our star. And so we're very, very disappointed to have lost her. And I don't need to say to this audience what a void in the heart of America and in the heart of public affairs her passing has created.
Dr. Adler, can you talk a little bit more about your relationship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and writing this book?
Well, she was terrific. She was so gracious to me from the time that I first reached out to her to indicate that I was writing this book on Reed versus Reed, which, by the way, she always said was pivotal. It was the turning point case in American constitutional history for the purposes of enlarging the sphere of gender equality and women's rights. And it was the case, frankly, that made her a household name in legal circles, because when she became involved in the case, working on behalf of the ACLU to write an incredibly important brief, she was at that point a law professor at Rutgers University. And while she was certainly highly respected within a narrow world of legal scholars, she was not very well known outside that little circle. When the Supreme Court unanimously decided in Reed in November of 1971 that in fact a statute that represents gender discrimination violates the 14th Amendment, equal protection clause, she suddenly burst into prominence across the country. So she's always had a great fondness for Reed versus Reed. And she opened her files to me, both her professional files and her personal files, at the Library of Congress. I interviewed her, which was a wonderful occasion. It lasted some 90 minutes, and she couldn't have been more gracious. And I'll tell you, every time I had a question after that interview, and I would email her, she would very quickly email me about a day later. And I was very flattered because she was a pretty busy woman. But I think that marked her interest in this case. And I'm very sad that the book wasn't finished before her passing, but her role obviously was huge in this case. And I hope the book does justice to the important role that she played and the incredible importance of her contributions to women's rights could never be overestimated.
Absolutely, and I'm sure you will do her justice. Shifting gears here, talk to me about this radio show, America Reimagined. You're launching it at a time that's pretty pivotal in US democracy, and I'm hoping you can tell us more about what the goals and intent are.
Sure. The thinking behind this program was that we needed to have a short program in which we could gather experts from around the country to talk about a great number of subjects and allow our experts to roam freely to contemplate what America might look like under different circumstances. And the program was born at a time in which people were pretty desperate for alternative policies and programs. And not to say that this was a program ginned up just because of particular circumstances in America, because the opportunity to contemplate and imagine a better nation has always been part of the American dream, right? And so if we go all the way back to the founding period, and we could look at so many of the founders' writings in which they frankly dream about what America might look like at some future date, this is really reimagining that opportunity, a new birth of freedom, as Abraham Lincoln called it. This is our opportunity to bring women and men to our show. And while we're right now focusing on Idaho and Western states, we hope soon that this program will be picked up by radio stations across the country. That's certainly our expectation.
Right, so you're carrying on a tradition that's 2,000 years old of reimagining what the world could look like and then taking action to get there. This is wonderful. Let's talk about what's happening in the world right now, the state of affairs in America and the prolonged election. We're now many weeks out from the election. What is Trump doing to undermine the results of the election? Can you talk a bit about his actions?
Sure. This is a very serious moment in the context of American electoral history, American constitutional history, and certainly the political future of the United States. Every candidate has a right to seek a recount in election. If he or she believes that the vote was close, why not seek a recount to ascertain an accurate vote? So there was nothing wrong with President Trump searching for recount efforts in those states that were particularly close. However, his continued prolongation of this election after the electoral results have been so clear in America now since a couple of days, at least after the election, is greatly concerning because it's become very clear that his effort to seek a recount was just a stepping stone. What he's really after, I'm afraid to say, is to overturn the results of the election, to subvert the will of the people. And this is very clearly evidenced in some of his efforts. So for example, he's gone to court in some 25 to 30 cases around the country, but particularly in those states where he had hoped to win, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and elsewhere. And he's failed to win in every one of them. And the reason is because he continually asserts without any evidence that fraud dominated and riddled this election, that there was an undercount, that in fact, ballots intended to support Donald Trump were thrown away. He and his legal team have concocted all kinds of bogus assertions amounting to misinformation. And both state and federal judges so far have dismissed these cases with a matter of minutes because he's been making these baseless claims. What's most disturbing now, I think, is his effort to persuade lawmakers in various states, principally Michigan and Pennsylvania now, to subvert the electoral process. And this represents, Caroline, a profound threat to our democracy.
Speak to us more about that. So what are the implications? Have we ever been here before? And what are the implications in terms of long-term damage to our democracy of Donald Trump normalizing or engaging in this response to the election?
That's a really important question. The firm, clear answer is no. These actions carried out by President Trump to subvert the will of the people, to circumvent the Electoral College, represent unprecedented efforts. And they amount to a direct assault on democracy. And Americans should understand this. You can be a Trump supporter, but you should understand that this is a frontal attack on American democracy. Because what is more sacred in American democracy than the right to vote and the right to have your vote counted? When Donald Trump and his legal team have gone into court and essentially asked judges to throw out votes legally cast, particularly and tragically, votes cast by African Americans, as in, for example, Wayne County, which is Michigan's largest county, encompassing Detroit, which has a very large African American population. This effort was profoundly racist. There is no other way to characterize it. And when he made personal calls to members of the canvassing board in Wayne County and sought to persuade them to refuse to certify the vote, one of the board members said, well, we can certify other counties which are dominated by white voters, but we can't certify Wayne County. This should upset every American to the ninth degree, including Trump supporters. And so this is an ongoing process to subvert our electoral system. And now he's engaged in the most desperate of acts. He's invited Michigan lawmakers to the White House, and he's going to soon invite Republican lawmakers from Pennsylvania. What's his aim? His aim is frankly despicable. And that is to persuade the legislators in those states to essentially ignore the electoral vote cast by voters and to replace them with Republican electors. And this would overturn the results of the election. And for those who are watching and don't quite understand what's occurring, it's only a couple of short steps between democracy and autocracy. Here's why, with a quick 20-second reminder of what happens with the Electoral College. As most viewers know, when you go into the voting poll, you're really, if you cast a vote for Donald Trump, you're not so much casting a vote for Donald Trump as you're casting a vote for a slate of electors pledged to support Donald Trump should the majority of voters in that state cast their ballots for Donald Trump. And then it's simply a conversion of the popular vote into the state's electoral vote. In those states where Joe Biden has won a pretty decisive victory, in Michigan, for example, by 160,000 votes and a decisive victory in Pennsylvania, Donald Trump now wants Republican lawmakers to say simply, we refuse to accept the results of this popular vote. We think in essence that the voters failed to make a choice, which then allows the Republican legislature to appoint new electors, not the electors pledged to support Joe Biden. And these electors would be Trump supporters, and then they would cast the state's electoral votes, thus representing what many commentators are calling, frankly, a coup against democracy.
Let's talk about that word for a moment. I know a lot of people think about coups as being military coups, but technically you're in a coup anytime you have a leader who does not accept the outcome of a free and fair election. Should we be using that word? Is that important in terms of holding Trump accountable during this time?
You know, that's a really important question. And it becomes a difficult question to address because we here in America have always assumed that votes legally cast would be counted and that every candidate would respect and certainly obey the will of the people. This is the first time in American history that we've had a sitting president refusing to concede, a sitting president refusing to accept the outcome of this ballot. And so what this represents, when we say he refuses to acknowledge the outcome and he's engaging in what can only be characterized as subversive efforts to undermine the rule of law, overthrow sacred democratic principles, it's fair to say coup in this case. And here's a distinction I would make. Many people consider a coup to be a military overthrow of a government. And that certainly is the popular way to utilize and to place into use that term. But a coup can also reflect an ongoing process to subvert constitutional principles and democratic values. I think there's a very clear parallel between the use of this C word to the word revolution. As you well know, revolution usually connotes a military effort, often a bloody revolution. But Aristotle told us 2,000 years ago that a revolution is fundamentally a change in foundational values. So a revolution does not have to be bloody, doesn't have to be violent. A coup can also likewise be relatively calm. The problem that our electorate faces is if we don't face up to the universe and don't recognize what's occurring before our eyes, then the concerns about the way in which President Trump is going about the effort to overthrow the will of the people may be too little too late.
Talk to us about that. What are the various scenarios that can happen between now and January 20th when President-elect Biden is technically supposed to be sworn in?
You know, at this point, in any other presidential election year, we already would have seen the director of the General Services Administration certify or provide the certificate of authentication demonstrating that the apparent winner in the election is Joe Biden. And that's all the statute requires, the apparent winner. And what that does is a couple of things. One, it frees up the funds in the Presidential Transition Act passed in 1963, amounting to some $20 to $25 million so that the president-elect, Joe Biden, can begin to hire people, to deploy people into the departments, into the agencies that he wants to staff. It also allows him, and most importantly, all those people whom he would hire to join his team, to fan out into those agencies, to work with federal officials, often bureaucrats, in various agencies to be brought up to speed on the status of policies and considerations at play. And this would include, of course, national security matters so that the Biden transition team could begin to work with their counterparts in the Trump administration and also then be informed about actions that other countries are taking abroad, actions by those nations whom we consider to be our adversaries, frankly, and to be the recipients of valuable intelligence information. That's important for an orderly transition of power, as you well know, because if there's not an orderly transition of power, then in fact, it means that Joe Biden would be delayed, would not be able to hit the ground running, so to speak, as Americans expect the incoming president to do on January 20th. And this means catch up for the Biden administration. And here the great damage is done. The delay means that if President-elect Biden cannot move on the most important fronts, ranging from national security to the obvious one, and that is addressing the pandemic, we can lose very valuable time over the next several weeks and months. And what that really means, as experts tell us through their sophisticated modeling processes, is that by March 1, we may lose 500,000 Americans. 500,000 Americans, really, because President Trump will not cooperate with President-elect Biden and give his team access to the offices, the information, and the funds that they need to put their pandemic plans into motion. This is tragic, and it's beyond bothersome, because what it means is that this president is promoting his own personal interests. These might be matters of a very deeply bruised ego. He is serving only his political interest, and he is not very much concerned about the welfare of American citizens.
One last question, Dr. Adler, about the long-term effects of this on democracy. Do you think that we will heal our democracy and fix it pretty quickly, or are you envisioning that this will be a long-term issue?
I'm very worried that this is a long-term effect, that what President Trump has done and is doing will be beyond a corrosive impact, because there will be Trump imitators in the years to come. And that's not even taking account of the possibility that President Trump will seek re-election in 2024. He's already told aides and friends that he intends to do that. That means that he will be on the scene. He will be working to continue to promote undemocratic means and policies. And as I say, there will be Trump imitators, people who have seen his rise to power. They'll look at his bombastic speech and his behavior, his indifference to constitutional and democratic norms, and say, wow, it worked for him, it can work for me. And because men and women in politics are often, not always, but often dominated by their own ambitions, they will seize those means to acquire power. And as we know from our nation's founders, politicians who seek power and develop that huge appetite for power have a hard time satisfying that appetite. That's what is profoundly alarming to me. And I think maybe the greatest fear I have, Caroline, is that Americans will believe less and less in our democracy. And I think this could be the profound, lasting legacy of Donald Trump. He has sown the seeds of chaos, disunion. He, by saying that this election is the work of fraud, who will be able to trust the results of every election that follows this one? Indeed, in 2022, which seems like it's just a couple of weeks away from now, what will stop members, candidates seeking House races or Senate races from saying when they lose, this was a function of fraud, the election was illegitimate? And we know that once the American electorate loses confidence in our electoral process, then democracy won't survive. That's how critically important this is.
Thank you for that rather gloomy, but I think practical and accurate, very accurate analysis of the stakes right now, Dr. Adler. And what's interesting is that I know that you would be making these arguments regardless of the person's political party. I have known you for many years, and I know that you were highly critical of President Obama's unconstitutional use of powers in the Constitution, and the same as George W. Bush. So just wanted to kind of put a final note on that, that this actually isn't about party, right? You are critical of anyone who violates the Constitution, and erodes our democracy. So that is the program today. And as we close the program, let me invite you to sit back and listen to this wonderful arrangement of America the Beautiful, arranged by our friend and brilliant musician, Steve Eaton, and performed by Idaho State Senator Cherie Buckner-Webb and the 8-year-old phenom, Charlotte LaValle.
Oh, beautiful, for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains, majesty.
Sea to shine.